This is a meeting of the SR2 Committee, Wednesday, March 14th. And we are going to wait a moment on our informational meeting. Specifically, we have some freshman members of the body that I think will be interested in hearing that discussion and probably not wasting your discussion on Representative Cruz and perhaps Representative Jensen, who have maybe heard it before.
Somewhat jaded.
So we will, at this point, open a public hearing on House Bill 3013. And I believe this is Representative Cruz's bill, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is.
Would you like to open with a little discussion on it, Representative Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I would love to.
Thank you.
It is always a pleasure to bring great concepts before the body.
Representative, below the car, please.
Okay. Oh, well. First off, let me say, Mr. Chair, that 3013 and 3014 are basically the same bill, the difference being that 3013 is a referral to the people if something happened to 3014 along the way. Where this came from, basically, was the fact that we now have good data that shows if we do hatchery programs white, we can restore wild fish via that process. Now, when I drafted this bill, I did, as you can see, it's not a very long bill, but this bill was intended to be something that when we got it here and had a hearing on it, that we would be adding to it. Fully understanding that there are differences in hatchery practices, and fully understanding that we need to be sensitive as to how we roll this out. It would be my intention that we put a fairly significant bar in place to where where hatchery fish could be considered wild fish. And we know the type of hatchery practices that we need to have to do that. The old-fashioned hatcheries that were purely for production obviously don't meet that standard. A lot of the hatchery practices in the state are designed for production and not for the type of for harvest production and not for the type of production we're looking for. That kind of fits into the fact that there's no way that we could find the resources necessary to bring all the hatcheries in the state up to standard in any specific time period. And so, Mr. Chair, I would love to have input on this. I have the sneaking suspicion that there may be some people that don't really like the bill. And the department was kind enough to give me a copy of their testimony beforehand, and there was nothing in there that surprised me. And there's some things that I might debate with them about, but I would like to have that in the process of trying to put the pieces in this bill that make it acceptable to enough people that it may have a chance to pass. I would also say that I think that the tribes at this point have demonstrated the fact that we can do this, and it can be absolutely valid, absolutely solid, and it's proven science at this point. And I think it's time that we in the state of Oregon quit playing around with these definitions of fish and got something solid that we can set bars and standards on. And I think this will allow us to do it. I know we had the department come in Monday to talk about how they're redoing their policy, and they talked about the right things in a general way. And this is no knock against ODF&W by any stretch, because this is the way state government seems to work, that they will come in and say, this is the direction we're going, and after you're gone, we'll write the rules around it. And my history with that is that sometimes we never quite get to where we intend to with rules. And something as important and vital to recovery of salmon in Oregon, I think maybe the legislature needs to make a stand rather than allowing a commission to do it. So with that.
Thank you, Representative Cruz. Any questions of the representative before we move to the public hearing?
Oh, you're missing a golden opportunity.
Yes. Cindy, would you have some comments for us on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did receive right before the meeting a fiscal impact statement from LFO. They have estimated, if it does go to the voters, they have given some figures. However, you will notice in the last sentence of the last paragraph, they do state that at this time, they're unable to make any determination of the final expense or if it does go to the next election. Just to bring that to your attention.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Tomei.
I do have a question. Just before I walked onto the floor, I received an email from one of my constituents, and I'm just going to read the questions that he has, if that's appropriate.
Please.
Yeah. Thank you. He said, currently, most river systems and basins in Oregon require the release of wild salmon and steelhead. Hatchery fish are allowed to be harvested if they have a clipped adipose fin. Mm. Which is done at the hatchery when the fish are young. Would this practice still continue if these bills pass?
Yes.
Would salmon, steelhead, and trout fishing in Oregon still exist as we now know it?
Yes.
Okay, and what are the economic impacts of the decision? And I guess what we're hearing is we don't really know that yet. Is that true?
If Representative Cruz's statement is correct that we still have fishing as we know it, now know it, then I guess we would have the same type of economic impacts if it were successful in having better fishing, then we'd have a different.
Mr. Chair, we're not getting into some of the details I'm hoping to work out, but would we still be clipping fins? We would be, simply because a lot of the function of a hatchery is to produce fish for people to catch. But what we're saying here is that we allow the fish come back and what people don't catch and makes it up the river should be allowed to spawn and be considered wild fish. So we'd be serving both purposes at the same time.
Okay, and he had one more question. Why is the legislature dealing with policy issues that should be dealt with by the FMW?
That is the question.
Fundamentally, I think that's a pretty easy answer to that. It is the function of the legislature to deal with policy issues.
Yeah. I agree, Mr. Chair. I mean, public policy is what we do.
We frequently rely on the state agencies, be it ODFW or the other agencies, for input and sometimes direction and help in determining these policies. But the laws of the state of Oregon are written by the legislature, not by the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
I shall get back to my constituent. Thank you.
Thank you. At this point,
sure.
Yeah, Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cruz, now considering or relating to the fish clipping, The section one says treat hatchery fish that are bred from wild stock as wild fish. Mm-hmm. So, would these fish be fin clipped?
It would be my intention that anything that's bred in the hatchery would be fin clipped because we still need to have harvest levels. When we talk about treating them as wild fish, is those that don't get caught and come back up, make it all the way back up to spawn, should be allowed to, which currently they're not.
Okay, thank you.
Sometimes they're not.
Right.
They are allowed to on the Umatilla. Okay. At this point, Mr. Bowles with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I see you're bringing with you the technical expertise here. No? Did you want to?
sure they, somebody that would come on these things that we called the fish lady, and whatever happened to her.
Mr. Chair, I can clarify that. The fish lady was Jill Sarnowitz, and she was the director of our habitat division. I'm actually more classified as a fish lady because I've been working in the fish division for all my career of about 20 years.
Then we will change the designation.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Director for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. ODFW offers the following comments on House Bill 3013 and 3014. These bills direct ODFW to modify the wild fish management policy to require spawning only wild fish in our hatcheries and allowing all returning fish to spawn naturally. It appears the intent of these bills is to modify the existing wild fish management policy, allowing transition to wild brood stocks for our hatchery programs, and allowing more opportunity for these fish to spawn naturally. If this is the intent, the draft approach for native fish conservation, which I presented to the committee on Monday, I believe will address this concern. Our new approach to native fish conservation recognizes the importance of both hatchery and wild fish. It moves away from a one-size-fits-all, strives to provide more flexibility and options for local watershed plans, and is consistent with federal and state ESA requirements. Given this direction we have taken, the current language in these bills has some important consequences for the committee to consider. Requiring only the use of wild fish for hatchery brood stocks would seriously constrain the management flexibility that we are trying to enhance. Both hatchery and wild fish are important tools in providing conservation and fishery benefits. The language in these bills could result in elimination of long-standing hatchery brood stocks that currently provide important fisheries. This even includes our catchable rainbow trout programs and private trout production. Some of these hatchery programs are mandated through federal, state, or private mitigation agreements and settlements. Our draft native fish conservation plan accentuates the importance of transitioning to locally derived hatchery brood stocks, but provides flexibility to do this on a case-by-case basis based on the need to balance the conservation and use of resources in the local watershed. The second point, which is letting all returning adults from hatchery programs spawn naturally, would also significantly constrain management flexibility. This may result in reducing or eliminating fishing opportunities targeted on returning adults if these fish must be allowed to spawn naturally. These actions would also be inconsistent with federal ESA requirements based on ecological and genetic concerns, which could cause the federal government to disallow Oregon's hatchery programs in areas of ESA-listed stocks. It would also be inconsistent with evolving scientific information on potential effects of interactions, telling us that we need to proceed with caution. Our approach strives to enhance the flexibility of hatcheries to provide both fishery and conservation benefits on this case-by-case basis, consistent with local watershed needs and the ESA requirements. Oregon and its federal, state, and tribal partners already have numerous conservation hatchery programs, and we are working together to provide additional opportunities. The use of hatcheries to aid conservation of ESA-listed fish is still experimental, though. As this tool is refined and tested, its application can be expanded if it's successful. In conclusion, we believe our new approach to native fish conservation, presented this past Monday, can address the intent of this legislation. The approach is not one-size-fits-all, but instead strives to explore management opportunities to provide a mix of strategies. This would be both within and among Oregon's watersheds. This mix must effectively balance the conservation and use of resources and also must be consistent with federal ESA requirements to avoid further restrictions on state management. We appreciate the opportunity to provide these comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Bowles, we are hearing House Bill 3013, but as you've heard from Representative Cruz, the two bills substantively are identical. And is it inappropriate for us to assume that your comments here therefore it could carry over to 3014 so that we don't have to...
Yes, Mr. Chair, and in fact, the heading of mine says 3013, but my first line includes both, so I apologize for that.
That's fine. That's for the record on that.
Any questions of the department?
No, Mr. Chair, I would say that it would be my request of the chair, because they are the same bills, that we have a hearing on this one and then just a tap hearing on the next one, because there's no point in having repetition.
Thank you, Representative Cruz. I just needed to make sure that the members testifying didn't have something extra that they wanted to say that they might be leaving out on this. So, maybe wanting to get a double whammy and waiting for somebody else to say something. I'm not sure. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming before us this afternoon.
Thank you.
At this time, Mr. Dale Blanchard from Clackamas. Good afternoon, Dale.
Hi. Representative Jensen, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dale Blanchard. I live at 19683 Sun Circle in Weston, Oregon. I'm not representing any organization today. I'm a licensed sport angler. I'm a registered voter and a lifelong resident of Oregon. I'm opposed to House Bills 3013 and 3014. First, I do not believe it's appropriate for the legislature to dictate fisheries management policy to this degree. I think that policy at this level should be left to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Commission. It should be based on biological research guided by the agency's mission as defined in ORS 496. Second, I believe this proposed statute would be detrimental to our threatened native fish populations. We need to continue to work towards restoring habitat to enable genuine wild fish to reproduce naturally. I don't think it's prudent to apply this law statewide. I think that each waterway needs to be analyzed and considered individually. You're going to find that this can be a very emotional issue, and there are a wide variety of opinions. My opinion is that wild fish are not raised by humans in hatcheries, and that the survival and the enhancement of naturally reproducing wild fish populations should continue to be our highest priority for fisheries management. My preference is that these bills don't proceed, but if you do decide to go on with them, I suggest that you carefully consider the possible side effects. You need to seriously consider your definition of wild fish. The bill states that hatchery propagation is to be from wild fish, but that hatchery fish are to be treated as wild fish. So, as of the second generation of fish, is it then okay? All the fish are wild, so where does the brood stock come from? You'd also need to consider the impact on federal endangered species and threatened species listings. If the state's definition of wild fish is different from the federal definition of wild fish, what does that do? Consider the impact on the selective fisheries that have been established with catch and release for wild fish and harvest of hatchery fish. And you need to consider the impact on trout programs. This, I think the legislation is geared towards the anadromous fish, but the way it's written would certainly apply to all of the hatchery trout in the state. Thanks for this opportunity to participate, and I try to respond to any questions that you might have.
Questions for Mr. Blanchard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask a naive question. Your definition here that, in your opinion, wild fish are not raised by humans in hatcheries. So would you say that that's a sufficient enough distinction to not equate wild fish with hatchery fish?
Yeah, I would say it's hard to say anymore what wild fish really are, because so many hatchery fish have been introduced at this point and have spawned naturally. To me, a wild fish comes up from the gravel in a river and from eggs that have been laid there by wild fish.
Thank you for your testimony.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Blanchard. At this point, Jim Myron from Oregon Trot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jim Myron, representing Oregon Trout. Oregon Trout opposes both of these bills. In our opinion, just simply stating that hatchery fish are wild fish is not going to resolve the issues surrounding the future management of hatchery fish in Oregon. We believe that such a declaration would only lead to further intervention by the federal government, further control by the feds. In order to for Oregon to fully implement the Oregon plan, we need to maintain control at the state level as much as possible, and we think that this would force the federal government to intervene. We believe a better approach is what the Department of Fish and Wildlife has offered to you in their draft of their new native fish conservation policy. We believe that that they ought to be provided with the time and resources necessary to fully develop that with scientific input and with consultation with the co-managers. So we believe that legislation like this at this time would be counterproductive. So we'll stand on that and be happy to respond to any questions.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you. Jim, let's say we draft, and fully understanding this is skeletal at this point, let's say we drafted a policy that NIMP said they could support. Does that change your opinion?
Representative Cruz, yes, it would. We'd be happy to take a look at whatever amendments to this bill that you intend to put forward.
Okay. And we will, Mr. Chair, just follow up, because we did have them earlier in front of committee basically saying that if we're doing hatchery fish right, that they would probably consider them to be wild, much in the way that the tribes are doing in the Columbia. So, which is kind of where this is all coming from, is I agree we have to have something that the feds will accept, or we're putting ourselves in a heck of a box here, so.
Okay.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Kafari, American Fisheries Society.
Mr. Chair, he's not going to like this either.
But I'm curious.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Kafari. I'm representing the American Fisheries Society. I'm not supporting or opposing this bill as our association is a scientific society and doesn't take policy issues. We just want to make some comments. I'm sorry I couldn't have my biologist here. There.
That was my question, Mr. Kafari. You didn't bring your hired guns with you.
I wish I had. They know a lot more about the issue than I do, Mr. Chair, but I have become educated since I've been working with these folks, and I have talked to them about the bill, and I wanted to make just a couple of comments. First of all, reading the bill and hearing what Representative Cruz as to say, I think that this bill does not represent what Representative Cruz intends. I think there's a drafting problem there, and I'd be very interested to see what Representative Cruz intends to bring forward. And just if I can make one other general comment, and that is that we think this concept, as Representative Cruz bring forward, is at this point premature. It may well be that supplementation works, but the statement from the American Fisheries Society, the Scientific Society of Fish Biologists in the state of Oregon, is that supplementation at this point is experimental. We encourage the experiments. We want them to be monitored and evaluated. But to state that this is the salvation of a fish in the state of Oregon, we think at this time is premature.
Questions, Mr. Troy?
Mr. I say, and yet we have successfully restored salmon runs where they were extinct by this process, and so I guess that confuses me where we say it's premature. So I mean, just a statement. I understand your position, but I'm not so sure that we are premature at this point.
I think if seems to me that a lot of things that we have, if we back away from fish a little bit, where we have used science as a tool, started out as experimental. In fact, it's, you know, kind of the name of science, but we do appreciate your position.
Mr. Chair, I agree that what happens, we gain information from experiments and we encourage experiments. That's what we do for a living is experiment and evaluate the results of those experiments. And we certainly don't want to discourage that in any kind of way. We just think that sometimes it can be bad science to jump to another conclusion before you have enough. This is an extraordinarily complicated situation, and because things look like they're working for a couple of years, doesn't mean at all that 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we're going to have answers that are not different from what we're looking at right now.
That's kind of like taking all the logs out of the river. I think with science at one time that we wanted clean, free-flowing river or streams in the mountains, and so we took all the large woody debris out.
Mr. Chair, I hear this over and over and over again as ha-ha, gotcha.
It's not a ha-ha, gotcha.
It is true that at one time the streams in the state of Oregon were enormously overburdened because we didn't have a Forestry Practices Act. And timber companies tended to dump their timber in the streams. And the streams were just frankly destroyed by bad timber practices. And there was concern that if we have to get some of the debris out of the streams in order for them to be efficient. Perhaps was taken by some managers, I don't think by some scientists, but by some managers to an extreme. I don't think that you can nail this on the fish biologists.
Perhaps, Mr. Kafori, I should have used something else as an illustration of my point. Let me take margarine and butter as the illustration. I grew up with the science telling me to eat margarine, that margarine was better for me and better for my heart. My last visit to the cardiologist, my cardiologist had absolute fits because I was eating margarine and not eating butter, because science is telling him that butter is better for me than margarine. And I think my only point, and I don't mean it as argumentative or anything of that nature, but my only point is science is in a constant state of flux.
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly my point. And I think for us to state that we have found an answer at this point is premature, and I think that science, good science, rarely, if ever, says we have found an answer.
Mr. Chair, by that very token, science can be used as a delaying tactic forever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we're not making policy decisions. You're making the policy decisions. We're not telling you what you ought to be doing, when the proper time is right, when it's not right. Those are policy decisions, and we're not stepping into that. What we're trying to do is to say that when we think that we have some knowledge and when we think we need more knowledge, and we're trying to bring that information to you about what the level of our knowledge is and what the level of our knowledge is not.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Donovan, Northwest Pork Fishing Association. Industry, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Phil Donovan, representing the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, and the Oregon Guides and Packers. Here to just testify that the people that I represent are very enthusiastic about broodstock programs. We heard nymphs loud and clear when they were here about a month and a half ago, and they identified broodstock conversion as being one of the very positive things we are doing in rectifying our hatchery practices. And with all the hatchery fish are swimming around this year, you know, it is, it's obviously of great interest to want to utilize those fish towards recovery. But we do want to register a couple of concerns about this legislation. First off, we're concerned about if we were to change to all native broodstock, we're sort of questioning whether what this would do to our current hatchery levels. And the concern there is simply, are there enough fish, wild fish, or broodstock conversion, to be able to convert to our current hatchery production levels? And this could in other words, bring down the number of fish that are being released. And, you know, frankly, if you're looking at it, we're wondering if you could get an incidental take permit of endangered species listed fish, you know, to be able to maintain those levels. So the other concern would be also in looking at, you know, our current hatchery facilities, and would they be able to handle the diversity needed to bring about wild broodstock conversion. You know, it takes a lot more runways, et cetera, to be able to take in native broodstock from, you know, early in the run to the middle part of the run to the late part of the run. And, you know, we've been very supportive of broodstock conversions. In fact, this last weekend on the Wilson River, you know, the Tualatin Valley chapter of the Northwest Steelheaders, they were out there, you know, catching wild steelhead, putting them into an acclimation pond, working with ODF&W as volunteers. And so, you know, we've got that volunteer support for the program. We like it a lot. On the other hand, we're just getting started with it. As volunteers, we've just been rolling on this for a few years, and we'd like to get a little bit more experience underneath our belt, a little bit more understanding of what we can expect in the future. So with that, we're stepping up to say at this point that we're not supportive of this legislation for those reasons. So, you know, we'd like to work with you to see if we can address that. I think part of it just may be a little bit of time. And with that, I'll close. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative
Cruz. I appreciate that, Phil. I guess, you know, one of the controlling factors in this is money, obviously. You know, it's almost shameful the amount of or the small amount of money that Oregon spends on natural resources in general, let alone any specific program. You know, I guess that will be a controlling factor here because, you know, hatchery wouldn't be able to be part of this program until it was modernized, and our ability to do that statewide is non-existent at this point in time. We can't go to all our hatcheries and you know, we don't have the money. We flat don't have the money. But I also see this potentially as giving us a direction and a goal as a state. So maybe we create more momentum to get more money into doing that sort of thing so we can ramp up the program. And I also think that as we do that and as we get success, that will build a momentum in and of itself.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, it is a big controlling factor, and when you look at who is funding it, when you look at the Fish and Wildlife Department, primarily a fee-driven agency, in other words, a small part of our population of hunters and anglers are paying the financial load. That's why, you know, we're supportive of the CHIP proposal, which, if I remember correctly, one of the four projects that's proposed in there gets at addressing some of these questions with regards to supplementation. And, you know, we're hearing conversations about using lottery-backed bonds, perhaps, to be able to fund that. And that's a modest proposal, $1.2 million, and something that we need to do. And it helps us get down the road where your legislation's going towards. Like I said, there's a lot of appeal in your proposal. So we'd like to get there.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. John Platt with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Council.
Good afternoon, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Cruz, I'm John Platt. I'm the official assistant, the executive director of Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. I want to thank you for requesting the views of the commission on these bills introduced by Representative Cruz. While the Commission has not had an opportunity to meet and take a formal position on these particular pieces of legislation, I'm able to comment on the bills more generally based upon the adopted Tribal Salmon Restoration Plan for the Columbia River by Konish Mimakishwit. In general, both HB 3013 and 3014 are consistent with the Commission's member tribes' policies regarding the need to integrate hatchery-reared and naturally spawning salmon. As indicated in Chris Beasley's testimony of February 7th, salmon managers need to start from the hypothesis that hatchery-reared and naturally spawned salmon are the same until differences are demonstrated, rather than to assume they are different until one proves that they are the same. The Endangered Species Act defines conservation as meaning, quote, "to use and the use of all methods and procedures which are necessary to bring any endangered or threatened species to the point at which the measures provided pursuant to the ESA are no longer necessary. Such methods include propagation, live trapping, and transplantation." Clearly, a review of the NIMS record since 1992 demonstrates that the agency is doing just the opposite by restricting the use of these tools based upon the premise that hatchery-reared fish are inferior to the so-called wild fish and will contribute to the decline of wild populations. Concerning the specific provisions of HB 3013 and 3014, Subsection 1 carries out the idea that hatchery-reared fish, which are bred from wild stock, are considered viable and should be allowed to spawn. While all hatchery-reared fish originated from wild stock, artificial selection can impair a stock's run timing or certain other traits, depending upon the number of generations that the stock has been in the hatchery and the management practices to which it is subject. In certain limited cases, for instance, the Kalama steelhead, there are traits affected by artificial selection that will limit the opportunities for these fish to contribute to naturally spawning populations. Therefore, a phrase indicating that hatchery-reared fish are considered viable unless proven otherwise may provide greater flexibility for management. With regard to subsection 2 of section 1, the bill acknowledges the need to regularly mix wild stocks with hatchery-reared fish in order to minimize artificial selection effects. However, in certain cases, artificial selection has affected a stock in a manner that it is unsuitable relative to other stocks as a means to rebuild naturally spawning populations. To use viable wild populations as a source of new broodstock for such a hatchery population may result in mining the wild stock without benefit to the wild population. Thus, the language might be improved by stating that hatchery propagation must include the use of wild broodstock at a biologically appropriate level. Finally, in testimony last week, I mentioned the Washington legislature is wrestling with some of the same problems that this committee is wrestling with. I have informed committee counsel of some of the solutions that they are recommending and commend them to your attention. They include bills that would require federal agencies to authenticate and justify directions to state hatchery managers. In other words, instead of asking NIMS to approve what you're doing, NIMS would have to demonstrate that they have the authority to alter or modify what you're doing before the state would allow them to direct the hatchery manager. Mm-hmm. Another bill recently passed sets a priority on the use of eggs for tribal and cooperative watershed restoration efforts. In any event, the states and tribes as co-managers with the federal government are stepping up to the challenge of reviewing federal policy and seeking modifications that are consistent with law and with the needs of their citizens, and that's a positive and necessary development. There are two other points I'd like to make, with regard to clipping, fin clipping, and selective fisheries. In the Umatilla, the tribes, and NIMS is trying to get some clipping going on to demonstrate where straying is occurring. But the tribes have really pressed to ensure that clipping, that mass marking, as it's called, doesn't take place. Because if you're mass marking those fish that are destined to be used for supplementation, you're basically making them available for harvest. But ultimately, the tribes are seeking not to have fin clipping and mass marking and selective fisheries. Mass marking is an expensive process in that it's expensive money-wise, but it's also expensive in terms of mortality, in that you have up to 20% mortality on the fish that are fin clipped. Selective fisheries are exert quite a bit of mortality as well on wild fish. Those wild fish, the hook is taken out of the wild fish and it's released. Well, sometimes taking a hook out isn't always easy. Some people would think, and you do have mortality, significant mortalities that occur from catch and release fisheries. To the extent that you integrate your wild stocks and your hatchery stocks, you don't have as much of a need to select for the hatchery or wild because they're the same. And that's what we're trying to accomplish in the Umatilla. So ultimately, in the long run, you wouldn't be doing that. We've had discussions with the Sports Fishing Industry Association folks on this, and we've had some very productive discussions. At the present time, it doesn't appear feasible, certainly for sports fisheries, to have those kinds of fisheries. In the long run, though, to the extent that you have Umatilla programs, Yakima programs, Clearwater programs being duplicated in other areas, you will be able to avoid those kinds of mortalities. The other point I wanted to make about experimentation, to a great extent, I think we could say that grain growing and animal husbandry are experimental, even though we've been doing them for thousands of years, in the sense that each and every time you plant a crop, or each and every time you look for a special hybrid or a clone to use in plant growing, or another breed to use in animal husbandry, you're taking a look at the environmental conditions that are occurring, as well as the qualities of the particular animal or plant. The same thing goes on with these supplementation proposals. Each and every one is experimental, but the techniques that are used are not so experimental as one would believe. One would have you believe. The Umatilla project was begun in 1986, and had results as early as 1989, and has had very significant results since then, and has been written about in peer-reviewed literature. The Hanford Reach Fall Chinook, which are the bread and butter of offshore fisheries, the Alaskan fisheries and the Canadian fisheries, are a supplemented population that was supplemented in the 1960s. The stocks of the Wenatchee, the Aniat, and the Methow are transplanted from the Grand Coulee construction. So this is not a whole new idea. Some people would have you believe that you have to severely restrict its use because it's experimental. Well, I think we would say it's experimental in each and every case you try it, and you have to have adaptive management, you have to have monitoring and evaluation. But this is not an experimental technique as such, and it's been done for many, many years, and it may have been done pre-treaty as well, as far as we know. So I appreciate the opportunity to comment on some of these bills, and Representative Cruz, thank you for introducing them, and thank the committee for this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, a thought just came to me. Following your logic, because I raise a lot of agricultural crops, and corn today isn't what corn used to be because genetically altered and made it better. One could assume that native corn in North America is extinct because it's all been genetically altered. So, and everybody seems to be fairly happy with what we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, I think the tribes are interested in seeing diverse stocks of salmon at all usual and accustomed fishing places. That's what the treaty right says. And those stocks are going to differ to some extent depending on what kind of water conditions they have. Mm-hmm. We may have gone too far in some of our hatchery manipulations of those runs to satisfy constituencies, rather than to satisfy the need to have those fish in ecosystems where they're providing nutrients to the entire ecosystem from the ocean, where they're providing marine nutrients. And so in the sense of the manipulations that have occurred, I think there is a very healthy rethinking of what's gone on in the hatchery up till now. But there's also the countervailing thought that maybe that to the extent the hatchery can mimic the environment in terms of providing cover, in terms of where the food feeding takes place, those kinds of things, that it becomes more like, as one of our tribal elders said, the difference between being born in a teepee and being born in a hospital. And so I think that you have a good point there, Representative Cruz. I think it's one that we're sort of going away from the kind of manipulations that resulted in stocks that weren't fit, and moving towards the idea that the best hatchery is the spawning gravel.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mr. Platt, on your fourth paragraph, you mentioned that while all hatchery reared fish originated from wild stock, I seem to recall some testimony a while back that wasn't true, that in some rivers at least, that hatchery bred fish came from other stocks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Tomai, ultimately all of those fish, every fish that's in the hatchery, came from a wild stock.
Perhaps, but not from that river's wild stock.
No, not necessarily. In fact, the kind of flexibility that the tribes would seek in supplementation is that you use the endemic stock of a particular river that's available. But if you're down to very, very small numbers, you don't want to take those small numbers out and put them in a hatchery. You're basically mining the wild stock. That's what happened in the Snake River Falls Chinook, for instance, where they mined the wild stock in the Snake River Falls Chinook, put it in the Lions Ferry Hatchery, and then the National Marine Fisheries Service declared those stocks endangered and said, oh, sorry, we can't use the Lions Ferry Hatchery. That's a hatchery fish now. Said, well, what happened to the wild stock in the Snake River? Those fish were taken out of the Snake River and put in the hatchery. So you do see those kinds of occurrences. Now, what the tribes would suggest is that under those circumstances, and actually we have peer-reviewed literature that goes back to 1991 on this case, you take the nearest available local stock that's healthy so that you can take a portion of that wild stock and use it for supplementing. Because homing and straying are two sides of the same coin. Salmon stray as well as home. They home to a greater extent than they stray, depending on what their home, the home that they're homing to is. For instance, in the Toutle River, when the Mount St. Helens went off, they couldn't go back to the Toutle River, so they strayed into other areas. That's a natural survival mechanism, and it's an instinct of colonization that's very important for salmon. So in that sense, it's not unknown for fish from one stream to go into a stream of another population and intermix, just as interbreeding, and that interbreeding is often results in what's called hybrid fitness, or a greater hybrid vigor, a greater, as I understand it from the biologists, a greater fitness as a result of the outbreeding that occurs.
Thank you, Mr. Platt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Platt, could you tell us if House Bill 1286 and Senate Bill 5463 have both been passed and signed by the governor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, my understanding that 1286 went through one House as of yesterday. And 5463, I'm not sure if it's gone through. It hasn't had hearings yet and hasn't gone through at this point. We present them not as past bills, but simply as ideas or concepts that are being considered by other legislatures for a problem that you're dealing with.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, at this time, Mr. Welsh with the Oregon Family Farm Association. And he did bring his hired family. Right, John.
Mr. Chair, Chair Jensen, and committee members, we agree with a lot of the last testimony, but what we really want to make known is Oregon Family Farm Association consider hatchery fish and wild fish our native fish, okay? We need to use the broodstock from both to augment the runs. I want to make sure that would happen because we believe that the hatchery fish are from the lineage of wild fish, naturally. The things that we can do to improve our hatcheries need to be done because we can certainly improve the procedures. We can move forward into a healthy fish return here by using both hatchery and wild fish. And we believe that maybe the language in these two bills is a little restrictive in that. And we find that requiring hatchery propagation be from wild fish could be too restrictive when we believe that the lineage is very close and that we should also use returning hatchery fish as broodstock also. So we think we could expand this and to improve possibly with some amendments of both bills to include that kind of language if the good Representative Cruz would be amenable to that. Because that's where a lot of us believe that we should go.
Thank you. Jim, I think certainly as you're aware, and I believe most of our other many of our other presenters this afternoon are aware that we do frequently in this building bring forth bills, as Representative Cruz has done, because in order to really begin the discussion on some of the issues, we need a bill there to begin the discussion with, to give us a vehicle, if you wish, or a vessel, if you wish, to finally get to language that is a good policy and that everybody wishes for, and so we do appreciate your awareness of this and recognition of
it. Mr. Chair, we believe that you as a committee should be making this policy also, especially for something that big an issue as this.
Glenn.
For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. I'd first like to address Mr. Bowe's testimony earlier. When he referred to the new approach that he discussed with you a couple days ago from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, I listened to his testimony and I read the testimony that he presented. I don't consider myself totally illiterate, but I had a hard time following that as to a clear, concise direction that was going to deal with this problem that we're addressed with right now. Now, I'm not intending to challenge the committee, but I'm wondering if anyone really got a good, clear sense of exactly what they were going to be doing, or maybe I just missed the point. The second thing is that from hearing testimony about the trout hatcheries and so on, perhaps the bill could be amended to simply address the anadromous fish, and I think that would certainly go along with what we're talking about. And maybe to make things too simple, but in reading these bills, what I would see would happen is that we would stop clubbing salmon to death in this state. That if there are large numbers of salmon returning, they could be caught by sports fishermen and recreationists. And I used to do that. I don't do much of it anymore. But it really hit to the heart and spirit of myself when I saw the videotapes of our Department of Fish and Wildlife killing our salmon that we had paid the money to put in the streams that went through the entire ecosystem and were able and strong enough, you know, with some people saying they're inferior stock, but they were strong enough to come back. But the problem was they came back in too big a numbers. And the other testimony was, well, if they come back, they attract the seals and sea lions, and the seals and sea lions eat the wild fish. That seems to be the only difference that I've heard anyone say, is that they come back a little bit earlier because they were a little bit larger fish when they were released, and so that's the only difference, is a behavioral concern. The idea that supplementation from hatcheries is premature, I'm again wondering if I've lost something, because we've been doing it for almost 100 years in supplementation with hatcheries. And so I'm wondering if we're, you know, again, back to the idea, who can prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that such and such a fish is a wild fish that hasn't been actually part of the supplementation process to start with? So I do think there is some reality to this statement, that if you can cause a problem, if you can cause a problem somewhere, then you have a reason to fix the problem. And I think we have allowed a problem to be created, and part of it was with a so-called wild fish policy. And then there are a lot of people who make a lot of money in fixing the problem that don't want the problem fixed, because then they don't have a reason to continue to fix it. I really think it's a very simple differences between what we're trying to do. I think these bills go a long ways with the suggested amendments to fixing the problem. Thank you.
I think, Glenn, that there will be a fish bill on cutting fish probably later in the session, so we'll probably have an opportunity to share your thoughts on that bill when we get there, too, if you would like. Are there questions of Glenn? Thank you very kindly. Appreciate the testimony. At this time, Ken Evans with the Fish Restoration and Enhancement Coalition. Good afternoon, Ken.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'll make this brief. It's pretty much everything that has, most everything's been said. Talked to most of you folks throughout the session and past sessions. Our group has been involved in this issue since 1994. I've introduced a number of pieces of legislation over the years in regards to the fish, you know, wild fish policy, what we've always termed to be the a retrofit and modernization of our hatchery system, unlike what you see industry goes through either annually or cyclically, depending on innovations in their business. I don't think Ford Motor Company produces Fords with the same type of equipment, not that our hatchery systems are that antiquated. The point is that it's a twofold problem. One, they're unable, in capital improvement-wise and technology-wise, to, I think, adapt to some of the science. So that's a kind of a
capital improvement problem. And number two is, I think, what this bill is addressing. And I'd like to, I know it's contrary to some of the other sport fishing folks who spoke, and some of the, and maybe some of the, I think the department has kind of said yeah and no all in the same breath. It's, I'd like to applaud the sponsor that in a perfect world, I think that if we could do something like this, I think that we'd all be better off. What would come out of the hatchery system, whether clipped or unclipped, if we had harvest or didn't have harvest, that type of thing, there's a lot of discussion about that, would be virtually identical to the wild population. Yes, we'd beat the devil for a short period of time of their life cycle, but we would have a product out there in the river system that we could get beyond things, discussions of stray rates, which I now are hearing that is kind of a mute point, and let's move away from discussing strays. But I've been doing this and listening to these committees since 1993 session, and that used to be the zig, and now we're zagging. And I like the attempt of this bill. I think that I've got a PhD scientist that has been before this committee before, Dr. Jim Lannan, who probably would say that this goes a little too far. There's a lot of good, like the previous comments by Mr. Welsh, indicated that there are a lot of good genetics. Mr. Platt alluded to bringing in stock from other rivers that staying maybe completely with wild stock isn't necessarily the route to go. But frankly, this would get us, it's rather draconian, but would get us to, I think, where we want to be with our populations. I've spoken with NIMS, not obviously as often as Mr. Bowles does, and Fish and Wildlife and some of the other folks, but during the Oregon Plan discussion, I sat down with them probably about a month into the session, one of their harvest and hatchery manager at the time, and he indicated that the challenge with hatcheries is not that a genetic issue per se, it's the how you sample the wild population and the genetics within the genetic traits within that population that you may skew the makeup of the total population of the fish, and that was a primary concern to him, not the change of using wild by wild crosses in a hatchery that you're going to act, for some reason you're two wild fish raised in a hatchery or that reproduce through artificial means in a hatchery are going to be anything differently than two wild fish spawn in the hatchery, or excuse me, on the spawning beds. That wasn't their concern. The concern was if you sampled the population and somehow did it in a very unrandom or did it in a fashion that you could skew the makeup of the total population, that concerned them far more. And then the other would be behavioral problems that are created within a hatchery, such as feeding on the top. I'm sure you've heard all that, those type of things, but we can overcome many of those type of challenges through modification, through capital improvements, through science. And I know the tribes have made a concerted effort. I've heard Mr. Platt and some of his predecessors speak in regards to some of the innovations. What I don't think is, I think we need is we need some leadership in this issue, because we're fighting. I mean, I'm getting tired of fighting this battle, and I know our folks are, and I know Donovan's folks are, and just about everybody here, and we need to move off the dime, and if it isn't now, when? We lose two more years. We get another dozen more studies that basically, as Dr. Lannan pointed out in some of the concerns with CHIP, which our group is supporting, is that it's just going to create six more questions. It answers four, but creates six more, and we're back to square one again. So I'd like to work with the chair and the sponsor of the bill, and our group would, and I'm sure others, and let's get something out of here that works. And
well, thank you very much, Ken. We appreciate your willingness to work with us, and we'll look forward to that and trying to get something out this time.
Other questions for Mr. Evans?
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Folks, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3013, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the Endangered Species Act, the Oregon Federal Comparison. We have Mr. Bruce, Attorney Bruce from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Martin Nugent, also from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for your patience here. We appreciate, and we appreciate members of the committee that these gentlemen are back here specifically at our request to explain the difference between the federal state issues as far as the Endangered Species Act and our fish issues that we would have. So with that, please.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. Again, my name is Charlie Bruce with our Wildlife Diversity Program with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. As we're passing around the handout there, just for, as a little background, Oregon's been involved with endangered species type issues since the early 70s, when the first Federal Endangered Species Act was passed. Our state act came along about 10 or 12 years later, in 1987, and was later amended in 1995. What you have there is a summary of the comparison between the two acts and the programs. They certainly are more complicated than what we have here, but we'll try to highlight the main comparisons. As we go through this table, on the left-hand side is, of course, our state act. On the right-hand side is our federal act. The administration of the act, of course, the Oregon Act, is by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. As I'll point out a little bit later, there also is another state agency involved. On the federal side, we have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Department of Interior and the National Marine Fisheries Service. The National Marine Fisheries Service, of course, deals with anadromous species, including marine mammals. The purposes of the acts are similar, to conserve species. The scope of the acts, and this is really the primary difference here, is the scope of the Oregon Act is it addresses state-owned or leased land only. Private lands are specifically excluded. The state act applies to all lands, both state and federal and private. The both bills address the definitions of wildlife that they cover. For Oregon, wildlife includes all vertebrate species, so fish, mammals, birds, amphibians, and reptiles. The federal act addresses those species as well, including invertebrates and plants. The legal authority for plants in Oregon actually is with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, so they have a program there addressing state species of concern. How does a species get on the list? Well, there are several ways, but primarily they're petitioned by groups or organizations. The process is similar between the two bills here, although the federal process can take considerably longer. The state process could take up once a petition is submitted to, say, the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have 90 days to determine whether it's valid information is provided enough to consider listing, at which point we go through up to a year process to review the existing data to see if, in fact, it does justify listing. The federal process can be considerably longer, and it's not uncommon to take 2 to 3 years. The standards for listing in Oregon and the federal bill are similar. We must have documented and verifiable information so that anybody would be able to understand why the need was to list such a species. The criteria for Endangered Species Act addresses species only within the state. And as you might expect, the federal act addresses and looking at the entire country. So often a species may cover multiple states, and so they have to consider whether or not a particular species is in jeopardy throughout their range. So they could be, for example, in trouble in Oregon, but the majority of their range may be in California or Nevada or Washington, and based on that determination, they may consider that it's not worthy of listing. Consultation in the listing process is extensive with state agencies. You have to go through peer reviews, public reviews. The commission can choose not to list a species if they feel that the existing programs, particularly the federal programs, may be duplicative of the state program. And so that gives the commission an opportunity to not duplicate some of the efforts that Fish and Wildlife Service or National Marine Fisheries Service are undertaking. Now moving to page 2, the definitions, threatened and endangered, are similar. Again, within Oregon, we're looking at species within the state. At the federal level, we're looking at species across the country or regionally. The issue of take here, take is the definition for Oregon is killing and obtaining possession or control. The federal definition is similar, but also includes significant modification of habitat. So, for example, as was in the case of spotted owl, if there was a termination that insufficient habitat was available for a particular pair or site, then that could be considered take. Species definitions are similar. Again, we're looking at vertebrates for the state of Oregon. On the federal bill, we're also including plants and invertebrates. Moving on to implementation, this is where we really spend a good part of our time, particularly with federally listed species. It provides, again, for consultation and cooperation with state agencies. We work closely with state agencies under our state act. Under the federal act, the federal agencies must consult, a landowner or another agency that may be taking an action that would affect a listed species must consult with either NIMS or the Fish and Wildlife Service. That can be a rather lengthy process. Under the state act, no person may take a listed species on public land. Under the federal act, again, no species may be taken on any lands, regardless of ownership. Under our state act, as it was amended in 1995, we're required, if the commission lists a species, to develop survival guidelines. And basically, those would be the standards by which state agencies would address protection or recovery of a species. Under the federal act, often, and this is where we spend a lot of time, we'll be involved with the development of recovery plans for these species. So there were plans developed in the early 70s up until the present, and those plans would provide the guidance for our agency, for their agencies, for interested parties, for landowners, and provide the steps to address recovery of those species. Under our state act.
May I ask a
question? Go ahead.
Thank you, and I know this is a thorny one, but it seems to me that one of the issues that we've been struggling with for all these weeks is the delisting criteria under implementation under the federal.
Right.
That is obviously difficult to define. I'm assuming there is no delisting criteria that the feds have been able to give us.
Well, basically, they would essentially follow it's sort of the reverse of the listing criteria. So if a species was listed because of concern for its habitat, then the delisting criteria would be to address whether conservation programs were in place to adequately protect the habitat of that species. So it's essentially the reverse of the listing criteria.
Well, I hear that, but and yet we don't have that in concrete, do we?
At the state level?
In the federal level.
At the federal level, it's not, Martin, perhaps you would.
No, Chairman, Representative Tomei, there are no specific.
For the record.
For the record, please. For the record, sorry, Mr. Chairman, my name is Martin Nugent. I'm Wildlife Diversity Program Manager, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you.
The in statute there is, it is not laid out precisely how that would be, nor indeed in code, but as Charlie Bruce indicated, the reverse procedure is followed at the federal level, and in addition to that, the recovery plan that the federal agencies do put together normally have recovery goals. They're not obligated to do so, but they normally do, and that is another form of guidance to indicate to the agencies at what point recovery has been met, and once that has been triggered, then that allows the process to delist proceed through proposed rules.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So, this we've been talking about the endangered species. Do we have that recovery plan? Do we have those guidelines, those specifics?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, the recovery plans are specific to particular species or runs of fish or whatever, and the recovery goals are specific to that listed species. And so they consider the biology of that particular species, its distribution, and establish what makes scientific sense to consider the population either not in danger of extinction, so it could reclassify to threatened, down from endangered to threatened, or indeed if it's not in danger of becoming endangered, there might be other criteria to take it off the list completely. It could be a two-step process. Threatened is not quite so severe as being endangered.
I may follow up again. So in talking about the coastal coho, so do we have a specific goal in mind?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, I'm not familiar with the whether a plan has been put or finalized on that. For other species, however, for non-fish species, if I may, for most species, a recovery plan is put together, but by no means all. The spotted owl is the example given. The plan was never finalized, but there were indeed goals established in that plan to trigger the delisting process.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good question, I think, Representative Tomei. It seems to me that in reality, when we've gotten to this, that people who were implementing or passing the laws in the beginning and then implementing the rules found a lot less need to talk about delisting than they did about listing,
mm-hmm.
Sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been one of our frustrations that we have with both state and federal agencies.
It's hard to know when it's such a nebulous goal when you've reached that goal.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think that's generally true. And, but please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. Going on there at the bottom of the implementation column, under the State Act, if a species is listed as endangered, it requires the development of an endangered species management plan by the affected state agency. However, as indicated there, it's really up to the state agency to determine whether what their role is in the conservation of this species. And so we would be working closely with them to determine whether, in fact, some type of endangered species management plan was needed. On the federal side, there at the bottom of the right-hand column, critical habitat can often be designated if a species is listed. And this has been done so, for example, in the case, again, of spotted owls in western Oregon. Usually a geographic area within which the services consider that the species is, needs to be addressed for recovery purposes. And so that particular area is designated in their consultations with federal agencies and so on. Specific concern is given to those critical habitat areas. Moving on to the exceptions part, these are very important to in terms of future options, particularly for private landowners. There are several categories there that of management that can be undertaken. Habitat conservation plans, there are a number of those in the state right now. State Department of Forestry has one plan for the Elliott State Forest. They're working on for another plan for all other state forest lands in western Oregon. They'll be addressing a number of species, both fish and wildlife. And by doing so, and by having this approved by both the Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service, they're allowed to proceed with their management programs and take listed species incidentally to their activities. So, for example, if they were to log a particular area and there happened to be a spotted owl or whatever in the vicinity, they would be allowed to proceed even if there was some implications as to a negative impact on that species. So what this does, it provides the landowner or the agency certainty to their management operations. So again, there
seems to me, Charlie, that there's a real gap here in the Oregon Endangered Species Act. I'm seeing basically nothing in the columns that you have for exceptions, or is this what the federal thing calls limits?
Chair Jensen, if a federal agency or say the Forest Service, say Department of Forestry enters into one of these, then any rules or guidance we have under our state act do not have to be considered. In other words, that would take precedence.
No, I'm talking about under the you talk about the exceptions. There's you have a habitat conservation plan.
Correct.
That provides for incidental take permits under the federal listing.
And
there are no exceptions under the, if it's not a federally listed item, but it's a state listed species, there are no exceptions. There's no habitat conservation plan in provision of law or rule.
If you go to the, Chair Jensen, committee members, if you go to the next page under incidental take permit, there actually is the means for a state agency to obtain an incidental take permit under the state act. And basically what they do is they would apply to us, identify what sort of action they were taking, how they would minimize impact to that species, and then based on our evaluation, we could issue them a permit. And actually, we're dealing with that right now with an interesting example in the city of Portland with maintenance of one of the interstate bridges. And we have a pair of state-listed peregrine falcons nesting on the bridge. So Department of Transportation will be working with us, applying for such a permit. And so this does provide them the means, a state agency, the means to without going through a rather lengthy planning process to adapt to the local situation.
Okay.
If we stay on that last page there, as I mentioned, incidental take permits are allowed as well as under federal law. We're also required to initiate every 5 years a review of the list that we have, and I believe there's a copy attached at the end of your packet there. The state act has no jurisdiction dealing with internationally. As you might expect, the federal act has considerable involvement with international treaties and agreements with other countries regarding trade, in particular in parts of endangered species. That basically concludes our comments there. Again, in summary, the Oregon State Act addresses just state land that is owned or leased.
On that, I would suggest that the interpretation of leased is somewhat distorted by the department. And that there are two types of lease that can be referred to. One is where the state leases land from me. The other is the lease where it leases me the land.
Correct.
When it leases me the land, though I know this hasn't been the interpretation of the department, when it leases me the land, it enters into a contract with me. And so far as I have been able to determine, there has never been a United States Supreme Court decision that set aside the Dartmouth versus Woodward case, which said that contracts are fundamentally sacred. The state of Oregon has chosen in the historical past here to treat these leased lands in another way, and we would respectfully suggest that there's some real strong difference of opinion on this as far as the chair of this committee and that action on the part of the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
One last comment. Implementation and management of endangered species in the state has always been a partnership with other agencies, with organizations, private landowners, and so on. And what having a state act has allowed us to essentially leverage that to provide additional federal funding for a lot of the recovery efforts we undertake. And so, for example, we're able to apply to the Fish and Wildlife Service, provide a 25% match, and over the last year or two probably have received $100,000 to $200,000 from federal programs to help implement recovery efforts. So it does, in that regard, provide a useful avenue for helping with recovery efforts.
Questions of the department? A very good presentation, I think, and very needed or worthwhile to try to get some idea. And at least I will find the written material that you presented us very beneficial for me as I look at these issues in the future. And I really thank you for that. Anyone else have any questions or observations? This Representative Cruz ran off. So.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just say, I didn't fully answer perhaps Representative Tomei's question earlier on. In administrative rules that we have, the Commission, Fish and Wildlife Commission established, there are criteria for removing species from the state list. I didn't quite get to the procedure under the state list, but I would like to just draw your attention to the fact that there are under the state list.
Under the state list, but not the federal list. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
So, may I just follow up? So,
yes,
does
please.
That seem to you sort of a moving object? It's hard to know. I mean, that's what I keep hearing all these weeks. Is it how do we determine when, what to aim for, number one? How do we know when we got there or even when we're close to getting there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, through the Act, endangered species management plans for endangered species are put together, and when those are pulled together by other agencies, in the scientific review that we undertake, we would consider pointing out what the numeric or the quantitative level of delisting would be appropriate, and the litmus test in the rules is very helpful. In a sense, it's the reverse of the listing process, but when we go through or are requested through petition to delist a species, the peer review process that we would go through, people would be invited to look at the test in the administrative rule to see whether we are at that point of recovery or delisting or whatever. And so there is the firm scientific agreement that we have reached that point. The danger of a species being in danger of reproductive failure is one of the key issues there, and demonstrating a scientific case built around those would be one of the things that the Fish and Wildlife Commission would consider upon delisting.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly. Appreciate your patience this afternoon. And pleasure to have you here and enjoyed this one. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
to close the informational meeting on the endangered species presentation, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3014, and we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3014. And do we have any announcements? Except that you all are welcome to come to Heppner to the St. Patty's Day Parade. you know, the folks, I'm not from Heppner and it's not in my district, but I'm sure the folks there would be delighted to have you come. And we are not in session on Friday then, and we will see you again on Monday. And with that, we are adjourned.